Well, how have you been?
Good. Very good.
Screwed in a little more.
All right.
I went down to a loft where William Burroughs lives and stuff, works out of downtown on the Bowery a couple of weeks ago, and did an interview with him.
Oh.
And I could not keep him by the microphone, so he would go back like this. I didn't even get up to walk around. A cat would walk into the room, and so I'm trying to work with this with these levels, and it sounds like, you know, these lofts in Manhattan are huge, and so there's all this echo, and trying to keep him, he had no comprehension of the microphone, as you do, of course. I know, I have no problem with you. So what have you been doing over the past, see, when did Glitz come out?
January, February.
Well, it's been...
I was probably here in February.
Mm-hmm. Quite a few months then. What have you been doing with your life?
Since then, I've been writing movies.
Writing?
Writing movies. In fact, since July of 84, I hadn't written any prose until the beginning of this month. November 1st, I started the next book.
That's that New Orleans novel.
Right. So it had been 16 months, and I started around the 30th of October, and I was very, very rusty. I'm not sure. I've written 30 pages. I'm still not sure if I have the rhythm going or not. I'll find out pretty soon.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Elmore Leonard being rusty.
Well, I work very hard to get to the point where I feel very... where I feel good about the prose. Now, this is my sound, and this is my to get to my natural, what I consider my natural sound. And then it rolls.
But isn't
and
right?
And it's a matter of, I think, knowing who everyone is more than anything else.
But isn't writing like riding a bicycle? Once you have learned to do it, can always do it?
I think you can get back on and fake it. Yeah. But I don't know if that you can sustain it for 100,000 words unless you have a good feeling about it, again, natural feeling. This is the way I write. You know, the attitude, an attitude. And the attitude is what develops this, is what gives you your style. How do you see things? Are you cranky, crabby? Are you, do you like people, you know?
And that's probably reflected in your daily writing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think I've always felt that I liked people in general, and then critics have said that the prose indicates a fondness for his characters. And I thought, yeah, I guess that's right. And I've learned things from critics, from reviewers, you know, like that. That's true. Yeah, you know, because they put into words things that I have felt that I've never described. So when I'm interviewed and I'm asked questions about what I do, sometimes I have to stop and think for a long time, or sometimes I'm simply stopped because I'd never thought about that before, about something that I'm doing naturally, you know, but not something that I set out to do. It's something that comes along.
Well, you've produced some 30 books, and many of them Westerns, and you were born in New Orleans, but have you set any of these books in the past in your hometown?
No, not in New Orleans, no. I went back last October, and it had been 30 years.
Since you'd been back home?
Since I'd been back, yeah. We left New Orleans when I was 2 or 3, then used to go back every summer to visit relatives in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. They lived in New Orleans, and they'd go over to the bay 90 miles away.
So it wasn't really like New Orleans was home.
No, but then we would go into New Orleans to see relatives on my dad's side, or would go in to have dinner, something like that. But I've always had a feeling, about New Orleans, that I felt that I would recognize it, I would know it, I would be able to fit right in, you know?
It's a very popular setting for writers. I was talking to... You ever read the works of Anne Rice? She wrote Interview with the Vampire.
Yes, I read that one.
And she has a new one called The Vampire Lestat.
Oh, yeah.
And she was born in New Orleans and raised in Dallas and now lives in San Francisco. But she says she can't get New Orleans out of her mind, and almost all of her books somehow or another go back to New Orleans and have at least a partial setting there. And it's certainly a popular setting. I can understand it's a romantic place, in a way, yeah, for a writer.
Shirley Ann Braw.
Yeah. Robert Stone. Stone. His first book.
That's right, Stone. And then there's a young lady who just came out with a book this year set in New Orleans. I can't remember the name of it.
Well, it's probably a good setting for a writer, but it's an overrated town, I'll tell you. It's such a decrepit, run-down town. It is. It really is. And tacky.
It looks
dirty.
It looks old. Now, Detroit.
I didn't tell Anne Rice that because she likes it more than you do.
Detroit is older than New Orleans.
I didn't want to bring up Detroit.
Well, I have kind of a fondness for both of them. I'm not sure why, but it doesn't have to be based on reason.
Do you find yourself defensive of Detroit?
Because
it certainly takes its knocks.
Just recently, I read an introduction of a book of photographs, Detroit, 100 photographs by a photographer named Balthazar Korab, who's a Hungarian, has been living in Detroit since 1955. And his publisher asked me if I would write the introduction, 2,000 or 3,000 words. On Detroit, not relating to the photographs, just what's Detroit like? And I said, sure, because Balthazar is a friend of mine. That's the only reason, because I steer away from requests like that because I'm not good at it. You know, this is essay writing or journalism, and I'm not good at that. Then I get all kinds of requests to do it, and I tell them, look, you're going to hear my voice when I write that stuff. You're not going to hear my characters. I have to get into and hide behind my characters in order to move a story, because if I just tell it myself, it's going to sound like a college composition at best.
Well, I bet you'd be good at nonfiction writing. It's a lot easier than fiction.
Oh, not to me. I struggled for 3 weeks to write 2,500 words. Struggled. And here it is. What do I think about Detroit? What do I feel? You know, I think, well, God, when you get right down to it, I'm sort of indifferent. It's there, and I live there, yeah, but I don't feel any patriotism. I don't feel any inclination to defend the city. So I didn't. I said, this is what the city's like.
What's it like?
And I said that it reached its peak in the 50s. And after that, instead of building up downtown, they built freeways and 700,000 people left town. And that's what happened. You know, everyone lives in the suburbs and no one lives in Detroit.
Well, it still has more than 500,000 people living in Detroit. They're human beings, their bodies. They inhabit the building somehow.
1.25 million in the city.
That many.
But there's not a lot going on there. There's a lot going on. The facade of Detroit, the riverfront, the postcard image, the conventioneer's shot of the town, that's there.
That big department store, Hudson's, closed, isn't it?
Hudson's closed. It put itself out of business by opening stores in the malls, you know, out in the suburbs.
Marge Piercy is a novelist and poet. She lives in Cape Cod now, and she was born in Detroit, but she thought it was a good experience for her and gave her a lot of preparation as a writer because of the combination of a stark urban atmosphere. But then there was a lot of greenery, too, at least in the neighborhoods where she grew up.
There is a lot of greenery. There's an amazing amount. If you get on the top of a high building and look north, that's all you see. And I said this to Balthazar Korab, and he says, yes, because it's a village. What it really is, he said, a lot of little villages stuck together, you know. Because there never was a downtown that was popular, a downtown where people walked around. People worked downtown. Those who worked in the offices went home. Those who not necessarily the suburbs, but to the neighborhoods. Those who worked in the plants then walked out into their own neighborhoods, and that's where the activity, that's where the social life took place.
Well, you live in Birmingham, Michigan. What kind of suburb is it? What's that like?
It's a
split level type of
something? Trendy. It's cute, you know. It's establishment though. It's kind of Eastern. It has kind of an Eastern look to it. Connecticut look to it.
Mm-hmm.
Grosse Pointe the same way.
Ritzy. It's a ritzy.
Ritzy, yeah.
Ritzy suburb.
Ritzy, but conservative. There are other areas in the suburbs that are more trendy. Birmingham is getting a trendier look, but most of the people who live there are quite conservative and more, I would say, Connecticut-looking.
In New York, when you talk about a trendy neighborhood, you're talking about an old, run-down neighborhood that's now on the way back up, like Soho or Columbus Avenue.
Yeah. Well, old frame houses in Birmingham that 10 years ago were 20,000 are now 300,000. Yeah, that, it's trendy.
I hope you bought a couple of them.
No, I'm not interested in real estate. My agent said a long time ago, when you want to make money, you practice your craft. That's what you do. You know?
I've been doing that for about 30 years, and I haven't made any money yet. Well, the title of your new book, which is a republication of three novels, is Dutch Treat. What's the title mean?
Well, this was made up by Arbor House. It's a catchy thing. Oh, that's my nickname. Oh, did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
That's my nickname.
I'm trying to get you to explain it.
Well, when I was in high school, I got that. The only nickname before was one, a home nickname, Bubber. Really, Bubba, but B-U-B-B-E-R. But it was only used at home, not out.
I can't see Bubber's Treat.
No,
that doesn't work
Bubber's
too well.
Treat. It was... No, that wouldn't be good. But Bubba is a popular Southern nickname, you know. It means so many little brothers got that from their older sisters, I suppose. That's where mine came from.
But George Will, in his introduction, says that Dutch stems from an old-time baseball player?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't.
His also name, last name was Leonard?
Yeah, he wasn't that old, though. When I was in high school, I was given the name in second year high school. There was still a baseball player, Emil Dutch Leonard, who was with the Washington Senators most of the time, most of his career. He was still pitching in the 40s, and he was in his 40s. He's a knuckleball pitcher. They last longer. And so I was given his name, and it stuck.
You weren't a knuckleballer, though.
No, I was a first baseman because I was left-handed. I played baseball in high school. That's all.
You were the athletic type.
I played football and baseball in high school.
Football? Well, you're kind of slim. Football might be decimating for you.
I was, as a matter of fact. But I liked it. I liked contact sports. So, and this is a Class A school in football, University of Detroit High School, in football and baseball.
Well, Arbor House is publicizing Dutch Treat as a republication of three early novels. They're not really that early. I mean, I think the earliest one goes back to 76, and so they're really late 70s. And one thing I noticed, that your style hasn't changed at all over the last 10 years or so. It's these novels read almost the way that your current novels, the last three or so that I've read, Stick and Glitz and the others. So yeah. Your style has not changed appreciably over the last 10 or 15 years, has it?
I wrote those at a time when I was establishing the style. When I had a pretty good idea what I wanted to do, finally, inspired to some extent by George Higgins. I read Friends of Eddie Coyle about the time, or just before I wrote 52 Pickup, which preceded those maybe by a year, those three. And what he did was what I learned from him was to jump right into a scene, get right into it, and avoid artiness, avoid writing sounding like writing, and just get into it and let the reader catch up. I don't know if he knew he was doing that, but that's what he was doing. Let your characters talk naturally. Just say whatever they want, and don't hold back because your mother might be offended by the language or something like that. And my mother was, and she said, "Why don't you write westerns. Why don't you write westerns anymore? They were so nice, and no one used those words.
They didn't know them back in the old West.
They didn't know. I don't know what they used back then. Because none of the writers.
We never will.
We never will. No. But they must have had some. But.
Well, The Hunted is one of the more ambitious novels that you've written. Swag, of course, introduces Stick.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Majestic, I like Mr. Majestic a lot, even though I like the style. I really moved. But even though the police work was a little improbable. For example, what's his name? The Frank, I can't remember his last name. Frank Rinda.
Yeah.
I can't believe that that he would have been able to have gotten out of the clutches of the police as easily as he did, and then make all these public appearances. I mean, after all, he was in a prison bus, which was hijacked by Majestic, and yet his lawyer arranges a deal so he doesn't have to go back. I mean,
was originally a screenplay.
Yeah.
And it was written for Eastwood originally, right after Joe Kidd, and before Joe Kidd, which was also an original screenplay for Eastwood, and before Joe Kidd was released, he asked me if I could develop something like Dirty Harry, only different, that he could own. And I worked up Mr. Majestic in the next week. Actually, the next day I called him up and said, what about this? And he said, that sounds good. Work it up. So I wrote a 24, 25-page outline and sent it to him. And I thought, sure, he was going to do it. And then at the last minute he decided, and he didn't have anything to do. But then, in the meanwhile, he had bought High Plains Drifter. And so now he had something, and he passed on that. My agent gave it to Walter Mirisch, who took it to United Artists. They showed it to Bronson and made a deal right away, and that was that. So then when it came time to write the book, I needed a little bit more. I needed to put some more flesh on it, and I had about a third of a book, or was it notes? It might have been just a lot of notes on a migrant worker strike story that I was thinking about doing, I think I had written about a third of it, 100 pages, and had given up on it. Didn't like the idea, or I've forgotten why, but I stopped. And I had a lot of material, strike material, which then I put into Majestic.
It was neat because as I read each scene, each chapter, I could visualize it just like a movie. It was, everything was laid out for me. Just I didn't realize this came after the movie, but I thought, yeah, it was the other way around. But I could see that visually. It was a very good visual presentation as we went on. In Swag, where Ernest Stickley makes his first appearance, that was had a different title. I think it was called Ryan's Rules.
Well, no, Swag was the original title. In hardcover, Delacorte. And then it didn't sell. It sold maybe 3,000 copies. So they changed the title to Ryan's Rules when Dell then brought it out in paperback. I didn't have... Unfortunately, I did not have a title. I had a title. I call it The Frank and Ernest Method. And that's bad. If you don't have a title before you're finished, you're in trouble. Because then somebody else might put a title on it.
The problem with some of the titles, word titles, is I get confused. I mean, I'll mix up Stick with Glitz and Glitz with Swag.
Yeah.
And I can't keep them straight. Can't you do something like The Sun Also Rises?
Well, I never felt that you had to keep them straight for very long. See, it was like using characters. Mr. Majestic.
That's easy to remember. That's
I know, but there was a guy named Majestic who appeared in The Big Bounce, you see, which I wrote in 67, 68. It was my first non-Western. All right, there's not going to be any... No one read it. No one read the book. So there isn't going to be any confusion until next year when The Big Bounce is reissued. And readers are going to say, what's Mr. Majestic doing in The Big Bounce? But he's not a melon grower. He's got a little resort on a lake. On Lake Huron. What is he doing here? See, well, I wasn't looking down the road when I was writing these for profit, for quick money.
Well, it looks like all of your material has been republished in the past year, hasn't it?
I think by next spring everything will be out again, yeah.
In addition to Arbor House, you're doing some stuff for the Mysterious Press, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. And Warner Books.
What's the Warner Books?
Mysterious Press has a deal with Warner Books, and it seems to me that both their imprints will be on the Hunted when the Hunted comes out in paperback next, and Mr. Majestic next spring, and I think the Big Bounce too.
Well, you're a wonderful writer. It's really a neat reading your stuff, and one of the reasons I like it, there's never a dull moment. I mean, everything moves, because you can get, I read so much stuff. I read 5, 6, 7 books a week, and when I find myself getting bogged down and not interested, I mean, it becomes an ordeal. But reading one of your books, it just goes through so fast, and sometimes it's so hypnotic, it's hard to put down.
Well, I think so many books sound the same, especially crime. And I don't read crime or suspense stories or mysteries as a rule. And publishers are sending me, I get 2 or 3 a week now to make some comment on, you know. And I don't read crime because it doesn't interest me, because it's so similar. All the books seem to me so similar the way they start out, especially Private Eye stories, which I can't read anymore. I think, and so I have that in mind. I keep in mind the fact that I want this to sound different, and I'll decide what a chapter should be about, what the point of the chapter is, and write it. And as I'm writing it, I say, well, give a little bit more, you know, get a little more effort into it, and do a little bit more, and. Make it, not only make it better, but make it a bit more unexpected or surprising. Or
how do you like working with the researcher? I know that you've used a researcher to give you some details about, well, for example, in Glitzen, other books, you know, the gambling expertise.
Because I never liked research that much. A long time ago, I did. But I'd go to a library and start researching, and then I'd get into something else. I'd see a book sitting there and pick that book up that has nothing to do with what I'm... It's like opening up an encyclopedia. You find out, and you come across something else, and you start reading it, you know? And I'd waste a lot of time. And there's so much time spent in research that my researcher, Greg Sutter, can go out and... he gets me always more than I need. And it's,
how does he present it to you?
Big boxes of books or boxes of if he records, he may interview, for example, the police in New Orleans. He spent 4 days with the police, talked to 4 different detectives, recorded it, transcribed it, and I've got about 140 pages of them, of their conversation, talking about all kinds of things.
I love research. It's like detective work, tracking down information that you need.
But you see, he's never that sure what I need. At that point, I want to get going, but I'm not sure what I need. I want to know something about the procedure, because procedures, police procedures vary around the country.
But he doesn't just give you a book, does he? Now, doesn't he, or does he indicate where in the book you need to locate the material?
Where, yeah.
Does he ever use a computer? I was reading in the...
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I was reading in the paper about a young man on the west side of Manhattan who is doing research for a lot of writers, and he does almost all of it from his house using a modem and a computer and everything.
Yeah.
He's got a whole bunch of clients.
Yeah. Well, this guy works for a film company most of the time. But it's sort of on a freelance basis.
You work out of your house, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How does your wife, Joan, like you underfoot?
Oh, fine. We get along very well. Yeah.
Doesn't mind. And I talk to more people and say, God, I wish my husband would get out of the house and give me some breathing room.
Oh, no. No, we get along. And she's outside a lot. She's works in the garden, at least during the summer.
I was reading in one of the profiles that Aberhaus sent that you used to be, or are, an alcoholic, but no longer.
Yeah.
And that you had joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell me about that. How did you know, or how did you realize that you were an alcoholic?
Well, almost all my life I drank more than anyone else. That is, more than most people I was with. Always had a very good time, and I was a funny drunk. Everything, I was a happy drunk, I mean, not necessarily funny. I thought I was funny. But it finally worked on my system physiologically. It had an effect that I couldn't take it anymore. And yet the system, my system demanded it. You know, and finally you get to that spot where into that position where you have to do something. You've got to quit, or you're gonna kill yourself. Which came in the early 70s. And, 74, I was in and out of the program until from around, well, say 75 to 77, January of 77, January 24th, 77, when I had my last drink.
January 24th, 1977.
Mm-hmm. About 9 o'clock in the morning, I had my last drink. Yeah.
That's etched in your memory, that.
It's clearly also on the back of a coin. On the back of an AA coin, it says LD 12477.
What effect did the drinking have on your work as a writer?
It didn't have any. I didn't write when I was drinking. I knew better than to do that.
But you didn't drink all the time. You only drank in the evening?
I drank in the evening, right.
Well, what about the next day? Did you have a hangover the next day?
Yeah, I very, very often had a hangover, yeah. Through the hangover and work, you know.
Well, I'm delighted that you haven't had a drink since January 24th, did you say?
77, yeah. Man, I quit smoking last month.
Now, that's good. Boy, that's good.
I'll tell you.
That's probably even tougher.
And working, no, it isn't. It wasn't tougher because it was, but it's 23 or 24 books I've written, not 30. But having written all of those with a cigarette in my hand, to start the new book without it was difficult. Yeah, but now I tell myself I just don't smoke. That's all.
Well, I know that Elmore Leonard fans who haven't read all your stuff are going to be delighted to catch up on three of the previous novels in Dutch Treat, and we're all looking forward to the New Orleans novel. I hope that you don't put a single name on it, like Stick or Swag. Can you call it something like From Here to Eternity?
Well, it's a single, another single title.
Thanks. I'll mix that one up, too. Well, you know, in a way, that's an advantage, because somebody will probably go out and buy it twice.
Well, I think of the art director who has to design that cover. Bandits is the new title.
That's a little different. That's Agatha Christie really threw her fans for a loop, because in the United States, a lot of her titles were renamed from the English editions.
Oh.
But then they would change it back to the English title and still be an American edition. So I know people who've gone and bought three or four copies of Agatha Christie, and they've read every one of them. And it's the same book, so Agatha didn't like that very much, but she had always said these were publishing decisions, and she stayed out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Elmore Leonard, it was wonderful having you back in, and I look forward to reading this New Orleans novel, and certainly wish you the best, and hope you enjoy your visit to New York.
Thank you, Doc.
I know you're chomping at the bit to get back to Detroit.
I am, to get to work.